welcome to Cypherpunk Bitstream, coming out of the TAZ0 in Berlin, Germany. This is episode number 0x02, and we'll see what topic we'll pick up later. I'm Smugger, and with me is
Frank Braun.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm currently a bit thrilled by reading The Sovereign Individual.
Seriously?
Yeah. It's been on my bookshelf for a very long time, and I finally picked it up and started reading it, and it reads like a crime novel.
It's been such a long time since I read it, I can't remember actually what it says. So,
well, what really got me was that they kind of described the different phases humanity went through. So basically starting with hunter-gatherers, going to agricultural societies and to the industrial societies or industrialization. And then what they're getting at is that we are transitioning into the information age. But what really kind of thrilled me was this idea or this realization that the state is actually a modern concept.
How do you mean?
Well, they basically describe it in the way that when they were hunter-gatherers, they had no property, they were roaming around, they had no fixed territory. And then basically with hunter-gatherer societies, people develop property. They had a fixed location that meant there was something to loot, something to steal, and that meant you needed defense, and that's how these principalities developed, and knights, and basically the medieval system. And that only later, when the industrialization really started, that it made sense to have large-scale violence and large-scale states. And that during medieval times, it was a completely different concept of states. You know, they had much smaller areas, they were inherited, there was no such thing as nationalism, and it was kind of normal that the ruler was like from a different country because he just married the right person or inherited it. And
I kind of think that skips over a large part of history, I have a feeling. Because, I mean, before we had the feudal society and all that stuff in the Middle Ages, I mean, we have a shitload of empires. Persian Empire, Greek, Roman, of course, you know, pretty large kingdoms in China as well. So those were highly developed states in a sense. I mean, if you look at Rome, for example, you know, you have the Senate and you have the Caesar and you have like the tribunes and all that stuff, you know. Okay, it mostly matters to the people in Rome and not, you know, for the other people in the empire that much, you know. But I mean, they had concepts like citizenship already, where citizens would have specific rights and protections under the system. So, and I think that the idea of the state is really that modern, you know.
Yeah, the idea is much older, of course, but it wasn't as ubiquitous. It wasn't everywhere.
True.
And somehow it really got me excited, or that's maybe not the right word, but I found it really interesting to think about that we take it for granted that there is a state, and there's basically a state everywhere. You know, the entire Earth had been more or less split up into territories.
True, but that has been true for such a long time. You know, I mean, all those medieval states and even before, you know, they claimed territory even if they weren't able to project power there. you know, I mean, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the Spanish or the Portuguese who basically declared all of South America to belong to their crown, you know. And up to that point, there were whatever 500 people ever going to that continent. So, in a way, there's a huge difference between the claim of territory and the actual ability to project power there.
Sure, and but it was also a totally different system. You know, it was like monarchy, and today we have mostly democracies, and you know, some totalitarian systems, communism. But just that, I just find it interesting that something which was completely normal, let's say monarchy was normal in many areas, now became totally rare, and something that never existed or that didn't exist at that time, like democracy, now is like the dominating thing.
Yeah,
where everybody thinks, okay, this is it. This is how it was for a long time, and this is how it always will be. And for me, this historical example just clearly shows that it's definitely not that things always will stay that way.
True.
You know, and that's, I think, is also something that it's not that easy to emotionally understand, that things don't necessarily will stay that way or have to stay that way forever.
That's a very good perception. I think you're completely right. And there might be something like a Western luxury perception issue here as well.
In what sense?
Well, you and I come from a background that is politically stable. We both haven't lived in a country that had war or major political or social upheaval yet. It's probably true for a lot of our audience as well, you know, that they come from relatively stable states. But if you just, I mean, it kind of depends on how far you want to go, but I'm just looking at the map that we're having here in the container, where there's this huge landmass of Russia and the huge landmass of Canada. And while all of that is officially the Russian or the Canadian state, there's a pretty high probability, if you live far enough from the urban centers, that you will see policemen mostly on TV, you know, and that the people you really have to deal with are your neighbors, which might be, you know, 5 kilometers away. And that stuff like big politics simply have no meaning for your life. I mean, we both live in a relatively modern Western democracy, and we live in the capital city. So, of course, the state is everywhere. You know, it's very perceivable. You know, you go on the street, you see the police, you have the tax authority writing you letters far too often, and all that stuff, you know. But imagine we would be, you know, sitting in the middle of Canada. They might not even know how to send us a letter, you know. So I think there's a little bit of an urban, Western urban perspective in there. And when you look at, I don't know, Somalia, for example, or to countries that are currently in conflict or coming out of conflict, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., then what the word state means might be very different from what we understand it. And I think that that might be an influence, but I think your main point is pretty good. That is, we get used to the environment that you're living in, and it becomes hard to imagine that something else was possible and is possible because one hasn't experienced it.
Yeah, it kind of becomes the dominant story.
Yes.
And we kind of believe in that story, and we often cannot even think that there might be another story.
True.
And it's also often an illusion. I mean, also something in Western societies a lot, that often the societies or the normal, let's say the average person doesn't have that much interaction with the police. So they, you know, because they live in a relatively safe way, they rarely get robbed. Their houses are not broken into. So they might get in a traffic stop. But most people, I think, also have this like illusion how much protection they actually can get from the police.
Yeah.
You know, like when I was in my libertarian development phase, I had the unfortunate situation that my laptop was stolen, like from my office. I left it there overnight, and then next day it was gone.
But the police found it again.
No. So I.
But they tried.
No.
So.
No, we had to call the police, and they recorded the incident and filled out the papers, and they didn't even send me the letter which they were supposed to send me that they didn't find the laptop. So it was just show. There was no protection. And I think, and I had similar experiences, you know, with trying to interact with like what's the name, like where you register property, and when you, the judges that deal with that, and
notary public,
yeah, the notaries, that was very inefficient and didn't really work. But I think most people, they rarely have the situation, and they live in the illusion that when they have a problem they can call the police and the police will actually help them.
Yeah.
But very often the police will just record the crime for the insurance. But they will not actually help you.
Yeah, and often they're too late anyways. I often make this joke that the police is an armed cleanup crew. You know, they show up and all the people are already dead, you know. However, I think it's a little bit flippant, you know. They do their job from time to time, you know. But I think you're right in that people overestimate what they're able to do.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And especially when you don't have to call the police, then you don't really know what they are able to do.
Right. And you might have the illusion that your problem is the most important problem they have to deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
Of course, I mean, at least that's my impression. If somebody gets murdered, they're actually on the case.
Yeah.
But for normal theft, it's basically filling out papers and
yeah,
that's it. And yeah, but another thing that kind of got apparent, like became apparent for me when reading this section was also the dominance of certain topics. Let's say today is very politically dominated. You know, it's all, everything is about politics. You know, it's intertwined with the state, but in medieval times it was the church. The church dominated everything. That was the dominant story, so to say. And that changed to politics. And now it's all about politics. And we kind of, I think a lot of people, they kind of think that that it really matters, you know. Although that also might change in the future to another story or some other thing, you know.
Well, again, I'm not 100% sure if that is right, because how often do I think about state politics per day? You know, that's not that much, you know. And I mean, you well, at least I mostly think about that when I switch on the TV, which doesn't really happen that often, you know, or read the newspaper, which doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, sure, but you're not the data point here. But that's what I meant. It's not like what you think about, but what is the dominant topics, like what you said, in TV, in the newspapers.
Right, right. But I think that a lot of the what is the dominant topic is mostly the narrative of rulership, always, because mass media is mostly about reflecting rulership and to keep up that illusion, you know, that it really matters. So, I mean, one of the things I happen to know is that the impeachment of this dude called Donald Trump, who appears to be the president of a country called the United States of America, that seems to be the most important topic globally, you know, because all newspapers are full of it. And when you really think about it, what impact that has on your daily life, especially if you're not in the US, that impact might be very close to zero, you know. But
of course,
it is for the milieu of the intelligentsia and the journalists, whatever, they live in that world and they want you to believe that you have to live in that world as well. But I think that is a lie. You know, even in the Middle Ages, do you really think that people were talking about the church all day? No, they weren't. You know, most of the time they were gossiping about their neighbors, calculating how many seats they have left for the season, looking after nice girls and getting drunk. I'm pretty sure that was true back then, and it's true today, you know?
Yeah, but I would disagree that it's only mass media. I mean, if you look at social media and if you try to look outside the crypto bubble, there's a lot of talk. It's a lot of talk about politics. It's a lot about, you know, this party or that party, or how we're going to save the environment, or, you know, how should you identify, or, you know, it's like all these topics are very politicized.
True. But I wonder how much of that has to do with most people that you connect on social media with. You don't share anything from your daily life with. You know, there is no other story you can talk about because you're not living in the same neighborhood. You don't have the same problems. You don't have the same friends. You know, it's just those remote buddies, you know. But
why do we talk about politics then?
Because that's the intelligent alternative to thinking about the weather. I mean, I'm sorry, but...
Is it that intelligent?
Of course it's not. Well, of course, I don't know. But it's... A lot of our communication is really about building social connections. And you can't communicate about too many things. You know, there's this thing that, you know, there are enormously stupid people that only think about objects. You know, they'll tell you, oh, this is my car and it has that many horsepowers, you know, and it costs that much. And then you have those relatively stupid people that then talk about people, you know? So they'll have no problem discussing the behavior and clothing and whatever of a person for like 10 hours straight, you know, without getting bored. And then you have those people that are slightly more interesting, let's say. They talk about events. So politics for me is like a mixture of the second and the third. You know, it's people that talk about events and people that talk about people. You know, I mean, nobody really talks about whatever Trump, you know, in the sense that they want to really understand his political ideas. You know, they talk about how he behaves, you know, how he talks on Twitter or whatever, you know. So in a sense, it's just a low form of gossip. You know, it's talking about people talking about objects and events, you know. And
like the hairstyle of Trump.
The hairstyle, hair color, whatever, you know. It's actually frightening that we know what they talk about, you know. But the really interesting topics are ideas. You know, people that talk about ideas, those are people to keep close because you can learn from them. And ideas might matter most in the long run.
Sure.
But talking about ideas requires a certain effort, I guess. And that's why a lot of people don't do that. You know, they talk on the lower levels.
But you said people talk about politics to build connections. I have the impression that it doesn't build connections, that it kind of builds different tribes and people are very separated and fight each other.
True, but the fighting with an outsider strengthens the connection on the inside. So it might have to do with the problem that our tribes are too big by now. So you have to split them again, you know, to make sense of the world. And it's always a good idea to have somebody else who is to blame for everything that didn't work as the big narrative promised. So polarization actually makes a lot of sense. You know, it partisanship, polarization. I mean, it's something that the Romans even did, you know, or was it the Greeks or whatever? You know, you had those sports things where based on where people lived, and sometimes even randomly, I think, people got assigned colors, you know, and that would define what player they're for and whom they're against, you know. So it's interesting that we kind of still have that thing, you know. It's divide and conquer.
I find it especially funny in the US with their like two-party system.
Yes, the two-party democracy.
Yeah.
That's exactly one party better than old Russia. Yes.
So, yeah. I mean, Germany, you have this illusion that you have more than two parties. I mean, there are more than two parties, and there's sometimes new parties are coming, and, you know, established ones, they get smaller, which is also pretty ridiculous. But
you know what's really bad? We're talking about politics now. We fell into the same trap. Ah,
damn it.
Damn it.
We should talk about ideas.
We should talk about ideas.
Okay, indeed. So how do we get rid of this politics bullshit?
Well, one of the ways for that might be the second realm.
What's that?
It's a strategy to get more liberty in your lifetime.
That sounds good. But we already have crypto anarchy.
Yeah, there's this little issue with crypto anarchy that mostly crypto anarchy only happens in the digital world. And we humans are physical beings with social interactions. And that might be surprising news for a lot of programmers and geeks and Aspergers, but people are physical. They do physical things. They need physical space. They need to eat. They need to sleep. They need to touch things. And they like other people around them. So while crypto anarchy is mostly on the net, the second realm also includes physical space in which actual human bodies exist and interact.
So it's basically bringing crypto anarchy into the physical realm.
It is bringing crypto anarchy into the physical realm and learning a little bit from other concepts. So it's not just crypto anarchy. I mean, there's a lot of overlap when it comes to concepts. But it's a thing that is strongly inspired by, for example, the writings of Hacken Bay about temporary autonomous zones. And it's also inspired by criminal organizations that have managed over the centuries to maintain their own autonomy, at least to a certain degree.
Okay. How does it bring crypto? How do these sources of inspirations, how do they bring, you know, the concepts of crypto anarchy into the physical?
Well, crypto anarchy is a lot about preventing observation and attribution. And physical autonomy either rests on the same principle, like preventing observation or attribution. So that's, for example, why you have, as a motorcycle gang, you have a clubhouse, you know, and you meet there. And within the clubhouse, you're hard to observe. Mm-hmm. And if something happens there, it's hard to attribute because nobody was going to talk. So that makes the inside of the clubhouse relatively autonomous, at least for a certain while. So it's the same concept, you know, no attribution, no observation. And the thing that one can learn from criminal organizations, Hacken Bay, is the cultural aspects that you form cultures, that you form expressions of your ideas in the physical world. And that you should realize that, as you said before, you know, the police isn't everywhere and does everything. Yeah, most of the time, most of us, you know, when we close the doors to our apartments, we are, in a sense, already living in a little bit of an autonomous sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And criminal organizations, but also cults, a few others, have realized that always. And have figured out that if they combine the same, the correct cultural elements, technical elements, structural elements, that they can maintain a relatively high level of autonomy for non-small periods of time. And they can, to a certain degree, experience freedom there or liberty there.
Hmm. What do you think would be the crucial elements there, like culturally and technical?
I think one of the realizations one has to have is that the state usually only shows up when there is reason for a conflict. And when he's called, basically, or when what you do is so blatantly obvious that they can't ignore it, because they have a lot of things to deal with and they have their own problems and they're lazy and, you know, all these things. You know, it's not like all of them are all the time looking out for ways to make trouble. You know, I mean, some of them are, but they're looking for the lowest hanging fruit. You know, they're not necessarily highly creative in annoying people. And I think reducing conflict with your environment and keeping your own conflicts internal is one of the cultural aspects that are fundamental. And when it comes to technical aspects, you shouldn't express your autonomy on TV necessarily or in the middle of the street, but it makes sense to have spaces that are hard to observe. So where a random bystander doesn't necessarily know what's going on or gets even better, a false impression of what's going on. So he thinks that, whatever, he's walking by a private bath and in reality it's, I don't know, the clubhouse of a gang, you know. So if you don't attract conflict and you don't have a big outflow of information to third parties, that's probably the main cultural and technical aspects.
I think even if it is blatantly obvious that they have their own space there, it is often still surprisingly effective. For example, for these outlaw motorcycle gangs, they usually have their clubhouse marked with their name, and but they make it really expensive to raid them.
Yes.
And so just by, as far as I know, for example, some of the gangs, when you want to raid them, you have to come there with 50 or 100 policemen because nobody will have their passport. Nobody will comply. They don't necessarily, you know, start like a shooting with you, but you really have to raid them by force. They're not compliant, and that kind of, you know, demotivates the police as well.
Yeah, true.
And it's the same for, I think, these, there are a lot of, like, Turkish, like, culture clubs, like these, you know, cafes in Germany where, in Berlin, you know, belonging to Turkish communities. It's, yeah, basically a lot of older dudes sitting around drinking coffee. But it doesn't seem to me that they are actually get controlled as much, you know, from the restaurant supervision authorities as normal restaurant and the restaurants and cafes.
Yeah,
I think just because it's different and it's a higher higher effort to do so.
Yeah, and I think a lot of things you mentioned actually are an overlap with what I said. So, for example, these immigrant culture clubs, they're usually not open for the public, but only for members, which makes them less interesting from a public safety, health, whatever perspective. So that is part of what belongs there. But I think that the other thing you mentioned, that's the non-compliance, is really important, because dealing with those groups, dealing with a motorcycle gang, is actual work. And even if they don't shoot back actively, it's very unpleasant. So there's another good example, that is squatted houses, which often are actively defended against raids. So they remove staircases, for example. Or if the police comes, they pee on the policeman, you know. It's not all-out violence, but it means that the cost of attack is so much higher than dealing with a compliant little old grandma, though grandmas can be terrible enemies. And I think that even the police is having, both on the individual policeman side as well as on the organizational side, they have a cost-benefit calculation. And if a policeman has been part of a raid on a squatted house or on a mafia club or whatever, he won't necessarily like to do that again. You know?
Yeah, I think so. If they have the choice and it's not like a lot of pressure from the higher ups, they rather go for easier targets.
Right. And especially if there's very little they can gain from that. So even police kind of needs to have a feeling of success or profit from a raid. And so if you raid the same club 50 times, you never arrest the person, never find drugs, never find guns, whatever, then it simply doesn't make any sense, you know. And sooner or later, the lawyer will come by and say, hey, this is harassment, you know. And the same is true for squatted houses. You know, if you raid the squatted house, you arrest somebody, but in the time you're there, the person is gone and you can't find any drugs that you can attribute to the inhabitants, then there's no actual success there. You know, so in a way, your only success has been overcoming people that have been nonviolent, but also not compliant. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like the definition of nothing, you know, and must be deeply frustrating. And if you talk to policemen, they will actually tell you that those activities are deeply frustrating because you can't actually go home and say, oh, I really accomplished something today. You know, oh yeah, I beat up a few 20-year-old squatters, you know, what did they do? Yeah, nothing, you know. So that's not a story you can tell your family. You know. And it's not a story that you can tell yourself. And then if you smell of pee because somebody peed on you from the balcony, it becomes less and less attractive. And especially if those places put in a lot of effort to not cause trouble, you know, they're not annoying the neighbors, they're not the source of, you know, a very public crime or whatever, then the police tries to look away, you know. And then often there are, you know, secondary effects like bribery and so on that make those places even more stable. But yeah,
I had a funny incident once on the S-Bahn that kind of taught me that principle by example. It was pretty crowded, and there was this like ticket checking guy. You know, sometimes you have these people coming on the S-Bahn asking people for tickets, and if you don't have a ticket, you have to pay the fine. And there were like these two totally drunk, badly smelling bumps sleeping on the chairs, you know, and you could see the guy was already, he wasn't really motivated to talk to them, but he kind of woke them up and was like, okay, yeah, you need to show your ticket. And they were both like, yeah, whatever. And he's like, yeah, I will come back. and then you have to, you know, give me the ticket. And they were like, yeah, yeah, whatever. And then he, you know, walked around, controlled some other people, and he never came back.
Yeah.
And I thought like, yeah, sure. What can he do? You know, he has to actually call the police because they wouldn't, you know, move. They wouldn't give him a ticket. He would have to call them, put the police, and they would have to pull these guys out on the next station, and they have to deal with two drunk bums who don't have a ticket. And, you know, so he rather skipped the case.
And in the meantime, you know, all the effort he would put into those two bums, he could find another 10 compliant people to arrest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or fine. Yeah, fine.
In that or case. Fine.
That's exactly. What he did. Yeah,
exactly.
And then he has more success to report.
Exactly. And it's far more economical either. Yeah. You know, I mean, he won't get the fine out of the bums anyways.
You know? Exactly. Yeah, so yeah.
There is actually no profit to that conflict at all. You know, and probably the only way he would actually call the police if those bums would start harass people. You know, then he kind of has to do it.
Sure, yeah.
And there's security risk, you know.
But they were not security. They were basically sleeping. So,
exactly.
Yeah. But I don't know. It was interesting to see that they had like this really believable fuck you attitude.
Yeah.
You know? And it worked.
Yeah.
Without them having to do anything. Just basically saying fuck you without saying fuck you.
Exactly.
You know? And that was a very effective strategy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean,
the smell and the look helped a lot.
True.
Yeah.
True. I think that in general, it's not the worst of all ways to deal with authority figures. As long as those authority figures have a way to escape the conflict. You know, sometimes people think that teasing the police and so on is a good idea, you know, or making fun of the state or anything like this. But making fun of them, teasing them, bad mouthing them actually gives them a personal reason to interact with you and to mess you up. You know, it becomes personal.
Yeah, never make it personal.
Never make it personal, you know, and always give them a way to escape the conflict without any doing anything. So if you make it very plausible for the policeman to look away and see, okay, there was nothing, you know, he will usually take their chance, you know, instead of going through all the hoops, you know, writing all the papers, having to drag you by your feet to the police station. So non-compliance is a high cost. If you combine that with lowering his costs of escaping the conflict, then that's actually a good idea. And if you really think about it, if the police is really what they say they are, or the state is really what they say they are, which is providers of security, then what you give them is the possibility to say, yeah, we did our job, you know, because we didn't immediately detect a crime, or we weren't attacked, or they badmouthed us or whatever. You know, you don't give them an actual mission to accomplish there, you know, and anything they could do would be a waste of time. And as long as you stay friendly, disengaged, etc., you might go a long way. Or if you're a rocker gang, you simply shut up. You know, you're not going to shout around, you know, bad policeman, whatever, because sooner or later you'll actually catch a fist to your face, you know. Instead, you just say no, you know, you don't comply. That's it, you know. Don't make it personal, you know. And the funny thing is, if you look actually at the social relations there, the same people that raid a rocker club and that are in a rocker club might actually share the same gym just a day later. You know, it's a very common thing that there's an overlap between those social circles.
Mm.
But yeah, don't make it personal. You know, don't give them anything that could make them feel successful. You know, exercising revenge on you will make them feel better. You know, don't do that. And instead, keep quiet, de-escalate, block them out, don't comply. And if it really goes bad and you cannot escape conflict by... Escape is the wrong word. You cannot defuse a conflict. You can escape it. You know, I mean, that's another thing that people often think is that to have liberty, you have to stand your ground. You know, that's not really true. You can, with a single time walking away, you can have so much more ground to stand on for the next 20 years instead of going to jail.
Yeah. And I think you, first of all, you have to escalate slowly.
Yes.
You know, so you always give the state or the opponent, whoever you want, however you want to call it, you give them a way to walk away. Mm-hmm. So you don't over escalate. And, but then when it comes to like a very high escalation, you can also leave.
Yes.
And I think what you just described about, these principles, we can actually, when we transfer them to how do we build a second round, you know, how do we build a TSZ? There are some important principles there.
Yeah.
For example, you try to be a good neighbor.
Yes.
And that's very, I think, very important that you, just because you don't like the state, doesn't mean you should piss off your neighbors. You should try to be nice to your neighbors. You should... also do business with your neighbors. That's also always a very good idea because it kind of buys you sympathy. Being nice and doing business with your neighbors, always helpful. And yeah, and try not to stick out, be obnoxious.
Yeah.
And being a close group helps that it's not a place that is open to the public.
Yeah.
And things like you shouldn't have anything open that is like in your face. For example, you know, in this squatted, there was a squatted area in Berlin once, and they had this outside art scene, which actually drew a ton of tourists, but they also had like this outside drug scene. And that's just like inviting trouble. If you basically have an open drug market, as much as it might be coherent with libertarian principles, it's just not smart to do that in the open and attract all of that attention.
Yeah, especially because the openness... So if you do something behind closed doors and the police knows about it, that doesn't necessarily mean that the police has the motivation to come. But if you do it in the open and the... servile society, as it's often called, points it out to the police, the police kind of has to act because they have to maintain the narrative of they are there to protect them and keep the laws and whatever.
What society is survey?
Servile society. The slaves, the people want to live in the state. And so in a way, the police has to act if they cannot look away.
It's a bit like these Görlitzer Park and Hasenheide in Berlin.
Yeah, nobody goes there, hence the police is not there often.
Yeah, but I mean, they still raided, although they kind of lost the game, I think.
Yeah.
But they still raided from time to time to give the
impression.
The impression that they actually try to do something about it.
True.
For the people reporting it or being annoyed by it who live there. And that's also an example where they actually annoy the neighbors.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who just want to go to the park and they don't want to be asked if they want to buy drugs all the time. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's good principles. So don't annoy your neighbors, a good thing. Have a good story to tell them as well. So because neighbors, of course, want to know who you are. You know, and you have to be able to give them a story that is not too wrong, because over time you might actually recruit them or progress to have a deeper relationship with them. So keep a certain mystery, don't tell everything, but give the plausible and unsuspicious part of what you do.
A subset of the real story.
Business, as you said, is great, but I also think that social relationships are good. So greet them, you know, just be a good neighbor. You know, that's the best way to say, you know, don't be an asshole. Just be a good neighbor. Don't ignore them, you know, build relationships because they're your allies. You know, I mean, we know that from experience kind of here, you know, when we actually had like state coming by and doing stuff and threatening, you know, people with regulation. And we didn't actually know that that was happening. So it was actually our neighbors that come over and say, oh yeah, there were those people here, you know, and they annoyed everybody and they said this and that, and this is going to happen. So they informed us, relatively deeply. And in a way, they also deflected the attention away from us a little bit because they liked us. You know, our neighbors in general kind of like us. And that is really helpful. It's really helpful to have good relationships because it's usually your neighbors that call the police on you, you know, and not some random stranger. You know, the random stranger is simply not there. It's usually the neighbor that sees things or thinks things, whatever. So you have to deal with them.
True. And I hope it goes without saying, but I think it's also a general rule that you should never call the police on your neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
And try not to call the police ever.
Exactly.
So if you have a problem with your neighbors or if you have any other problem, try to solve the problem yourself. You know, I mean, it always boggles my mind that people actually call the police because their neighbors have the music too loud and they do so without talking to the neighbor. You know, and that's something, if you actually have any freedom ideals in you, you should never do that.
Right, because it reinforces the state.
Yeah.
Because the state actually thinks that it's needed, you know, and it can show that it's needed, you know, because they show up to harass your neighbor for you.
And regarding the story, I think in general, it's always important to give people a story. If you don't tell people a story, they will make up a story.
Yes.
And it's usually a pretty bad story.
Yes. You have to direct that a little bit.
Yeah. Doesn't mean, like you said, it doesn't mean that you should lie to people or make up this ridiculous stories, but some people, I think they try to be more private, and then it kind of goes into the paranoid.
Yes.
And then when somebody asks them, what's your name? They're like, what do you want to know that for?
Yes.
And it makes them like totally suspicious, although they have, they don't really have any deep secret they have to hide. It's just that they become so closed up that they look super suspicious. Instead
yes.
of just telling them, if you don't want to tell somebody your name or
your
legal name, just make up one.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's even better, before they ask you, you just tell them your made up name.
Exactly.
And then it's much more believable that you actually have that name.
Yeah, the first words out of your mouth should be, hello, I'm Jonathan. And everybody is free to copy that name, by the way. So
exactly. Yeah.
And I think it already points towards the core ideals of the second round strategy, is that through, on the one hand, having no outside conflicts, keep all the conflicts that you have internally, keep them internally, don't start conflict with the external world, be non-compliant if you actually run into conflict, so make it expensive to be attacked, have nothing that can be gained from attacking you, so if you have trouble with your local government because you're in Iraq or Iran or wherever there are bad governments, you know, don't give them anything that they could profit from when they attack you. You know, there must be nothing to gain. And don't point out what you're really doing. Be unobservable. Whenever you have stuff at your place that is problematic, make sure that's not attributable to any person. And ideally have a good security culture or environment. We can maybe talk about that later. But in general, you have to understand that the Second Realm strategy is actually, it's something like security politics. You want to treat the state around you a little bit as if you're a state yourself. So you have diplomacy with your neighbors. You have a certain kind of passive defense, etc. So in a way, it's really conflict management that you're exercising there.
Yeah, which goes back to that you want to escalate the conflicts slowly.
Exactly.
And sometimes it is better to talk to a policeman visiting you.
Yes.
And instead of...
And we had that here, like 2 or 3 times that we had police here. Not because of stuff that we did, but because of things that happened in the neighborhood. And we talked with them. And of course, we didn't tell them what we really saw or who we really were. And it kind of worked out. And they never asked twice, I think. But it would have been so much more problematic, you know, to shoot at them. You know, that would have worked well.
Yeah, or just say like, I'm not going to tell you anything.
Yeah, exactly. But,
when they just investigating a real crime that happened in the neighborhood.
Exactly.
So then you make yourself super suspicious and it escalated unnecessarily.
Unnecessarily.
There are situations where that is the right way, of course, but the right response. But in that situation, it wasn't. So
Yeah, being uninteresting was the best thing to do there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really important to learn how to manage conflicts. You know, if there's a conflict, de-escalate it if possible. If you have to escalate slowly. Become a non-good target. You know, don't be a victim. That's really the thing. You know, don't be a victim. A lot of people just comply because the police says something. You know, maybe just look at them and play dumb. That often works like amazingly well.
Yeah, then you make it harder for them to enforce,
right.
Enforce the rule. It's like the what was the strategy for border crossing? The dumb business guy,
exactly.
Or the tired
business guy.
The tired business traveler
exactly.
Was a bit
exactly. Confused. I'm just here to sell vacuum cleaners, exactly. Yeah.
And nobody wants to deal with that guy, so
because you might have a vacuum cleaner afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you touched on it already that you shouldn't really have something to gain when you raid a TAZ or like, yeah, if you raid a TAZ or which maybe we should talk about this today a little bit about the idea of containers, the idea to have property that you can take away.
Well, I think that's a relatively big topic, but we'll handle that in detail in another episode, I think, because otherwise we are going to run into 4 hours again.
Okay.
We shouldn't. But one of the core technologies of the Second Realm is the temporary autonomous zone, which means it's a place where you can implement those aspects of non-observability, non-attributability, and also to a certain degree manage capital. But it's temporary in the sense that you are aware that if conflicts escalate too much, that you take all your capital and you go somewhere else, you know, and restart. So doing that, I mean, we thought a lot about that, you know. I mean, I think we first had the Second Realm idea, and then we talked about how to build a TAZ, actually. And there were people that said, let's rent or buy a house, actually. Let's buy a house or let's rent something. But the problem with all those places is that they don't allow you to easily escape a conflict, which means that you're always forced to continue escalating a conflict.
Yeah, and if you lose, then you lose all your investment.
Exactly, and you can't restart.
Yeah, like you said, we're gonna have another episode just about how to implement that principle with containers.
Yeah.
But Yeah, it's very important to highlight the principle that you have to be able to take away your property if you have a conflict.
Exactly.
I think it's very similar to what a lot of the cryptocurrency people are doing.
Yes.
Trying to take the money out of the state system, put it in a system where it cannot be seized. And it's a very similar concept there that, and it kind of leads to containers or to RVs. It leads to everything which isn't like bound to a physical place.
Exactly.
Because then you cannot take it away. You have all your investment there. If you rent, it's even problematic if you rent it, because if you build something into a rented house, then you have investment that you will lose when the landlord kicks you out. And if you buy the house or buy the property, then it's even worse. It's a huge capital loss you have to take.
Exactly. And with something like mobile capital, you have this ability to undermine the OODA loop of the conflict party. So, I mean, the police or criminal gangs, which is another problem for Second Realm concepts. The police is not your only enemy, you know. Your actual enemy is usually criminal gangs. And they don't just appear out of nothing. You know, there's a process that leads to escalation and attack and all these things. And if you're able to undermine that process by disappearing, then the attacker has to restart the process, essentially. And if your issue is legal, then just moving to another city or to another state might actually lead for the complete process having to be restarted with new people, with new evidence, etc. And that is enormously costly. And especially if the attacker knows that there's nothing to gain, if the attacker has no personal motive to attack you, then all that effort might simply not be worth it.
I think it kind of restarts the process for almost all attackers.
Right.
Like even like some criminal organizations, they're usually locally bound.
Exactly.
They might have chapters in different cities, but it's the same like with the state. When you go to a different city, you're dealing with a different part of the same organization. So that means they have to kind of start from scratch.
And their motives might be vastly different.
Yeah.
Their restraints might be vastly different, etc. Exactly. So if you're able to undermine the OODA loop of your attackers, you usually are in a really good position, even if the attacker is much bigger than you, much stronger. You can do a lot with just being faster.
Yeah, and I think also the environment itself is hugely important. I think, for example, Berlin kind of worked pretty nicely so far because they're pretty overwhelmed with a lot of stuff. So if you keep a low profile in Berlin, that's a much lower profile than a low profile in, let's say, Munich.
True.
Right, where they you would stick out like a sore thumb and
true.
Have problems quicker.
Yeah, in a way, by us going to a place where one kind of potential attacker has a very busy day also means that a lot of their enemies become our enemies. You know, so it's in a way, it's a balancing out of risk between a lot of attackers, so that for them, you're just one of many. You know, they deal with each other a lot, and the probability of us being harassed or attacked drops because of that. You know, we're just a random pick from a relatively large crowd. But it also means that out of that relatively large crowd of violent organizations, we might have to deal with more than just one of them.
Mm. I'm just wondering if we're a bit too abstract. Maybe just to bring it back to the actual, you know, the actual goal. I mean, the actual goal of Second Realm is to build like these spaces of freedom.
Yes, physical systems
in the physical realm.
Yes,
and
but also social and cultural. So.
Yeah, and it's similar to what we talked about in the last episode about that we don't want to reform We don't want a rebellion, that we want to build parallel systems. And it's the same thing, not just in the virtual space, but also bring it into the physical. Like you said, we are physical beings. So if we have these parallel systems in cyberspace, that's great, but it can never be enough because we do not live in cyberspace. We have our bodies. So we have to transfer the concept into the physical realm. And, that's why it's called the second realm, because yes, it's an alternative in the first realm.
Exactly. It's an alternative that actually lets you experience more liberty.
Yeah. And I think that's also very important to highlight that there is no such thing as the one true and only second realm. It's a general concept and many different ways how to approach that concept or to realize, you know, these alternatives in the physical realm should be tried at the same time.
Yes, the second realm is the totality of everything that is constant based and outside of the state operated realms. So, and that means that it's not just a space, you know, even though we're physical beings, it's not just space. But there are other aspects that are really important, as, for example, social institutions. Because they're not just physical, but we're also social. We want to cooperate with people. We want to experience people. We want to experience things with people. So there are a lot of social aspects, social institutions, so to speak, that when you think about the state provides a lot of that. You know, they have protection, they have a justice system, they have banks, they have money, you know, all these things, laws, are social institutions. And if you separate yourself from the state, then it's not just a physical separation, but it's also a social separation in the sense that you cannot mix this second realm space with the first realm institutions. You need your own second realm institution.
Which doesn't mean that you don't need rules. You will still have, I mean, once you bring a group of people together in your alternative physical space, you kind of need to come up with rules how to deal with problems.
Right, but since what you said, the second realm is not just one space, you know, not one thing. It means that different implementations of places in the second realm can have very different rules. You know, it's there's this concept of rulescaping that you build your own environments with rules and come back to one of the best definitions of anarchy that exists, in my opinion. And that is that anarchy is the freedom of people to join groups of their choice.
Yeah, and like you said, once you have multiple of these realms with their own rules, then you have the problem of how do these rules interact, which is rulescaping, which is probably also a whole another episode again.
Someday, yes.
Yeah.
We should do that.
Yeah, it's a very, I think it's a very interesting problem, how different rule sets can interact. And it's also something that you will have in one TAZ.
Yes.
Right? Because I think that's, for me, that's one of the big problems with the state and also with democracy, that we always, in a democracy, we always try to come up with the one rule for everybody. And I think that's simply not necessary in most cases. Yeah. For example, you know, if you have your own space, your own flat, I mean, there it's kind of obvious. You have your own flat or your own container or whatever. You should be able to decide, is it allowed to smoke there or not? Is it allowed? Do you have to put your shoes on or do you have to put them off? You know, things like that. And I think that this principle can be extended much further so that you have, you know, subsets of rules in TAZ that interact with each other.
True. And I mean, it's again, you know, a calling towards how we actually build TAZs, which is a different episode. But it's kind of interesting when you think about the rules that you have in different places in the second realm, is that one of the biggest issues with the state system is that the cost of exit a rural system is extremely high. You know, getting out of the state to somewhere else is really, really expensive, you know, really risky. And that makes the state so powerful. You know, you have to put up with a lot of stuff until it's really feasible to escape, you know, if you can at all. And if you want to preserve liberty in the second realm and in second realm spaces, you have to take that lesson and say, okay, it must be really easy to exit. You know, I mean, we had that here as well, you know, where the only thing you have to do basically to leave this second realm implementation is to show up and say, I leave. You know, that's basically it, you know, and then we delete you from the mass mailing that we do, you know, and that's it. You're not a member anymore. You know, you turn in your keys and that's it.
Yeah. And if you have your own property here, you can take it or exactly. You can also leave it and donate it if you want to, but
or sell it. Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. I think this is, when I first got into libertarianism, I was also interested in seasteading where they had this, you know, concept of we need competition with states. And one of the big problems is, yeah, that there are not so many states. They're pretty big, and it's very, very expensive to switch service providers.
Yeah.
You have to basically sell all your property, like if you have any physical property. You have to sell it. You have to buy it in a new place. You have to learn a new language. You have to leave all your friends. You need a new job. So it's really expensive to change to a different state.
And it's much cheaper to actually change from the second from the first realm to the second realm, because the second realm might be implemented physically close to you. You know, there might be a TZ in your city, or you know, just a clubhouse or whatever. Or you might have certain service providers for good services, etc., that you can interact with locally. So you can begin to participate in the second realm without actually having to give up your first realm friends, for example, or to say goodbye to your family forever.
Yeah, I think it's also something we discussed a lot in the beginning, that the membership in a TAZ in the second realm, it's a gradient.
Yes.
It's not like, oh yeah, you're now part of the TAZ or part of the second realm, or you're still not part. In my vision, at least, it's a gradient, you know. In a TAZ, you would have people that live there like all their lives, or you know, maybe some even never leave the place. You would have some people just visiting as tourists or guests, and some people maybe they work in the TAZ. They are merchant there, and then
they just party there.
They party there, or the other way around. Maybe they live there. It's some sort of, you know, alternative living, and then they go into the first realm and, you know, put their suit on and go to an office job.
Exactly.
You know? And like you said, you should be able to change. Change service provider, so to speak, without having to change your physical space, or not having to change that much.
Yeah. And I think that's, I'm kind of smiling because you mentioned seasteading before, because a lot of the ideas for Second Realm are actually an upgrade to seasteading to some degree. And I personally like to call TAZs the seasteading on the land,
you know,
where you basically go a certain step towards more liberty. You actually implement more liberty, but without sinking millions into a floating platform that is not going to survive the next hurricane or the first Navy ship coming by. So, and that is another thing with Second Realm, because in a way it's an overlay to the first realm territory, which makes it much more ubiquitous and much more fluid, and so much harder to actually interact with when the first realm wants to attack you. You know, for example, if you're, you know, the settlement in the middle of the ocean, you know, and you happen to interact with a few cruise missiles, you know, nobody might ever know what actually happened, you know, and who's to blame for it. Or if you're living in the depths of the Canadian forest, you know, you have your own space there. You're like a sitting duck, you know, and there's absolutely no collateral damage that would happen if anybody attacks you, you know. But if you implement the second realm as an overlay to the first realm, you go and hide in the city, for example, then the attack of a rocker gang on you, you know, is something that will draw attention, which gives you some form of second party protection in a way. Or if the state would want to bomb you away, you know, that's not going to easily happen unnoticed.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we also discussed that a lot in the early days. So what would be the best location for TZ? And we kind of settled on that you actually want it in a city. Yes. I think a lot of these alternative communities, they have this idea that they should be very remote. And you already touched on it. I think it has two problems. One is that if somebody attacks you, there are no witnesses.
Yeah.
You're like this sitting duck in the middle of nowhere, and they could just send a cruise missile, basically.
Exactly. Or a drone. Yeah. That's what they do these days, I think.
Yeah.
A reaper.
Send a reaper, and you're gone, and nobody really notices. And the other part is that, like what I said, with these gradients of participation, when you're in the middle of nowhere, there is no gradient of participation.
Yes.
Because there are no network effects. You can't just, like, let's say, go to Meetup, you know, or visit the place for one day. If it's, like, let's say, a day to go get there. I also think that it's definitely in cities.
At least for now.
At least for now, yeah, sure.
Exactly. So if Second Realm places become much bigger and much more advanced, then we can think about, you know, greater distance, and it might make sense then, you know, you might not want to be the whole neighborhood. You might not want to take over a whole neighborhood, though maybe you want, because there are historical examples for that. We should actually go to that, because that's really interesting. But the other thing is that if you have the second realm society, and the second realm society is relatively small, then you will actually have the problem of not having a market that is big enough. So you actually want to interact with as big of a market as you can. You want to buy stuff and you want to sell stuff. You know, you want to be productive. And if you're in the middle of nowhere, that can be extremely costly or even impossible, you know. So you will be very unproductive. You won't be able to build capital and you won't be able to have much influence. So it's not just the gradient, which is completely true, you know, because there's no binary decision of now it's just second realm, but it's also when it comes to actually being able to live, you know, it's so much easier in a modern society if you have a big market that you can deal with.
Yeah. And I think that the second realm, to be successful, it has to be high tech in many areas. So it's probably not going to work being like this, you know, self-sustained farming operation without any tech. I mean, there's nothing wrong with self-sustained farming. I think it's a great goal to try to be as independent of the system in many areas as possible. But at the same time, like you said, you have to interact with it, and you have to use the network effects. You have to buy technologies from your environment. You have to sell to your environment. You need money flow in both directions, you know.
Exactly.
People working outside, bringing money in, people selling stuff inside, stuff like that.
Plus your second realm installations actually become a service provider to people that are in the first realm.
Yeah. You know?
So be it, for example, here we have this concept of providing a surveillance resistant place for people in the future where you can have meetings, etc., which is interesting for businesses, etc. Or we have events here, or let's not talk about all the things that we're doing here, but the people around you in the first realm are potential clients to you, you know, and when you service them, you might actually attract them as well, because the second realm is an invitation only system. You know, it's nobody is forced to enter it. You know, we invite people to enter it and they choose to enter it. And for that to work, you kind of have to convince them. And convincing often is most effective if you do it in bigger numbers than in smaller numbers.
Yeah, and if you successfully provide a service to the outside world, you also buy yourself some goodwill.
Exactly.
And at the same time, you have you kind of have the ability to teach new principles,
the cultural aspect.
Yeah, by your own rules, like what Parallel Nepalis is doing with having a Bitcoin only place or exactly. A cryptocurrency only place. Somebody told me there that it's much easier to teach somebody cryptocurrencies by showing them, you know, here's how you buy it, here's how you use it, instead of giving like a 2-hour talk. And
I think it comes back to what you said early in the beginning, you know, this ability to envision that something could be different because you never experience it differently. You know, can you envision it at all? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, for us, it's hard, you know, to envision that there could be anything else but the big nation state, you know, with whatever democracy or whatever system, you know, because it's outside of our experience. But if you can taste the second realm, you can begin to imagine more of it and believe more of it.
Mm.
You know, it's not a theoretical construct.
Yeah.
It's a growing implementation of principles and seeing those principles at work and seeing people that do it and see that they're not assholes but nice people, you know, and that they think and that they might be interesting and that they might be productive, etc. That is attractive because it is concrete. So the second realm is a very concrete strategy. It's not like you have to convince the masses to vote for whatever libertarian party that then reforms the system and everything will be fine. You know, no, it's a single person experience that grows.
Yeah, I actually experienced it when we started building this place. I think people, they work on different levels of abstraction. Mm-hmm. So they need a different, some people really get very abstract things without having any physical implementation. And for others, it takes different levels of physical implementations. For example, when I read the books, The Second Realm, for the first time, I really loved the concept. And, you know, I tried to convince some people, you know, trying to show them the book. And it was a really hard sell for most of them. And then we saw it here, right? When once we had like our first container, and we had meetings there. There was some people who got it immediately. You know, they got the concept plus they needed the concept plus one container.
Yes.
And then once we had, let's say, what do we have now? Six or so?
More, I guess.
Then even more people got it. You know, yes. They walk in and it's like, oh, okay, now I see what you mean. It's like the place makes an impression.
Yes.
And probably if you would have 50, 100 containers, then even more people would get it.
Yeah, and sooner or later, you can't not get it.
Yeah.
You know?
You might not like it, but...
Yeah, but you will get it.
You will get it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, I mean, the second realm, of course, changes with its size. You know, or every system in the second realm changes with its size. And there's always the risk that second realm systems fall back into the first realm because a lot of conflicts only become really troublesome if you become big, you know? I mean, look at, you know, the conflict between a rocker gang and the police, you know, the conflict there is about being arrested and thrown into jail, you know, but if you look at the conflict between states, you know, we're talking about death and war and all these things. So conflicts change in nature with size, and so do systems. And I think that's a warning that each Second Realm system should be careful not to become too big. You know, even though it's more convincing, the bigger it is, there's this sweet spot you don't want to overstep. You know, you don't want to be a national security threat ever. You know, that's not the point, you know, because you don't actually want to have conflict with the First Realm. You know, it's the First Realm that starts the conflict. It's not us, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a general principle. You don't want this monopolization.
Yes. So
you don't want a huge Second Realm. You want many small Second Realms that also interact with each other and are also different in many ways.
Exactly. To keep adaptability and not fall into, you know, systematic traps, local maxima, and become vulnerable, you know, to everything again. Because those big monolithic systems are so vulnerable against systemic failure and attack. And you don't want that. You know, in the Second Realm, every system should remain as small as it can. I think that's probably the best general rule of thumb, is that you try to remain as small as you can. You know, if it makes sense to grow because you have to, you know, because it's not sustainable, then yeah, then probably grow, you know. But as soon as you reach this point where you say, okay, this is sustainable, this works, then multiplication might be better than just growing.
Yeah, or you grow and then you fork off a part and move it somewhere else.
Exactly.
That's where it might be more feasible to have TAZs in the countryside.
Exactly.
You just fork off a part from the city and then you have traffic between them, you know, maybe people who are also become like traveling merchants between different Second Realms.
Exactly. I mean, that's the long-term vision, basically, is we would really like to have container-based TAZs, to be exact, all over the world, because it would allow you to a certain degree to actually take all your stuff and move somewhere else without ever leaving the Second Realm. That would be really nice. And it would also allow us to have a much larger distributed market, much larger distributed system. So if trouble starts somewhere, you know, you can flee or it doesn't bring down everything, you know. And it's this systemic stability that by distribution or decentralization that really makes sense to a certain degree. But it only makes sense if those entities are actually independent enough. You know, if they can have their own ways and rules and everything. And if a system is far too big and has only one rule, then because of this conflict that it can have with other parties, it has to adapt more towards the other parties. And I think a good example for that is Bitcoin. I mean,
remember, today we are on Bitcoin fans.
Oh, right. We're Bitcoin fans today. So a good example for that is...
No, go on.
Bitcoin. So in the beginning, when Bitcoin was relatively small, there was very little thought about how to interact with the state. You know, the state completely ignored it, basically. And now we're in this phase where you have those opposing forces in the Bitcoin community. You know, you have people that say, we want to be separate from the state, and others that say, we want to be regulated and accepted so we can make more money. And that's a classical conflict that you get with a big system. And it threatens that a system like Bitcoin, which might be a nice Second Realm system in the beginning, might actually be sucked back at least partially into the First Realm. And then its usefulness might decrease dramatically.
Because it is integrated too much into the First Realm.
Because it has to adapt to keep conflicts low. You know, because of the size, it has been identified as an enemy by the state or by a target, as a target. And then it either has the ability to ignore the First Realm, but then everybody in that system that is dependent on the one system has something to lose. You know, you can't, you can't make a good calculation anymore about how that conflict should be solved. You know, you cannot move easily, etc. And you're kind of stuck with the system. And the system is too big to adapt.
Mm.
And then in the end, in those scenarios, usually fear wins. You know, it's a fear of losing what you have.
I find it funny that, I don't know if our listeners know, but we're working on this digital transfer system called Scrit. Value transfer system called Scrit. And a lot of times when we talk to people about it, the first impulse is, okay, how can we make this like the world dominant cryptocurrency?
Yeah.
You know, or the world dominant payment system. And then we always try to explain them, look, it might be better to have like 1,000 Scrit.
Exactly.
You know, have like one for every community and focus more on making it interoperable. How do you can change between these different implementations?
Yes.
Because that way you make it much more resilient than having like this one global payment system.
Yes.
It's the same for cryptocurrencies. It might be much better to have a lot of them and a good way to exchange between them than having this, you know, one currency that rules them all approach.
Exactly. And that, and it basically demonstrates why cheap exit is so important. You know, this interoperability between payment systems is nothing else but a cheap way to exit. And if you're able to exit without losing too much money, without too much effort, then you can adapt to the circumstances. And since you have a lot of choice, you can still operate, you know. But if you're forced to stick to one system and the environment changes or your circumstances changes and your cost of exit is very high, then you have to solve your problems in a different way. And that is usually by compromise. You know, you have to compromise with whatever the other conflict party is, because you might not be big enough to actually have a real standoff. And in a way, you want more fluidity. You know, you want federated systems, easy to exit, highly interoperable, highly understandable, adapted to local circumstance. Because the world is relatively big and very different. You know, I mean, even certain parts of the Second Realm strategy look very different in different places. You know, so in developed nations with a good legal system, you will be able to make use of the legal system to defend yourself to a certain degree. While in other places on this planet, you might not invest in lawyers, but in weapons.
Yeah.
You know, so you adapt to the environment that you're in. And yeah. I think that is really important, this getting the idea of being adaptable to your environment. Yeah. There's usually not one big solution that works everywhere. You need small interoperable solutions that can infect the world.
Yeah, it might actually be part of the status mindset, so to speak, that this drive to always have this one solution for everything.
Yeah, dominance.
You know, it's like, what the European Union, it's also something like that, right? They want to integrate all the European states into a bigger entity, and some people want to integrate it even bigger, you know? And I think it's a mistake to try to do that with technology. It's generally better to have multiple solutions that are...
I actually think it's wrong for everything, not just technology.
Yeah,
you know, or maybe define technology differently. You know, I mean, even the state system is a technology. It's a social technology.
Sure.
So, and yeah, the Second Realm is a technology, even if it doesn't involve computers or whatever, it would still be a technology. But I think you're completely right. And that is, I think that systems that are based on power have to grow power. And in a way, every system multiplies its essence all the time. You know, it's if you're driven by money, you know, you have to make more money all the time. You know, if you're driven by social interactions, you have to make friends all the time. You know, if you're driven by power, you have to get more power all the time. And this usually happens if you have this dominant value, this one essential value that will multiply. And with the second realm, this dominant value is actually liberty. You know, you always thrive to have more liberty, you know. And that means that it's not about having the same system everywhere, because that requires power, you know, and it comes with power. No, in the contrary, you know, you kind of want other second realm implementations to be different from yours.
Yeah, and like you said, you want this easy exit, easy change.
Yes.
Like with cryptocurrencies, that's there why distributed exchanges are so important.
Exactly.
Atomic swaps, where you don't need a centralized system to change. And then if you don't like one, you just sell it.
Exactly.
You don't have to change it. That's how the market works. You sell it and buy something else.
Exactly.
And, it can be generalized into other areas as well.
Yeah. And I think it also has to do a little bit with humbleness, because it's easy to think that you have this one good solution, you know, and that you figured it out, you know. And I think sometimes we have to remind ourselves that we're not actually intelligent enough and know enough and are predictive enough that we can solve every problem, you know, all the time for everybody, you know. Instead, we should focus mostly on the problems we know, which are our own problems and the problems of our friends, you know.
And you kind of have to design change, or the adaptability, or the possibility to change. You have to design it into your system.
Yes.
If you're humble, you know, whatever design you come up with, it's not going to be perfect.
Yes. And it will be full of mistakes.
And even if it's kind of perfect for the current situation will change, and then you have to change as well. So you have to build in adaptability and path to change, which is going back to cryptocurrencies again. That's why you could see there that governance became that much of a problem. Because I think for me, that's one of the biggest problems Bitcoin had, is that they didn't really think about the governance problem. And then...
But we're Bitcoin fans in this episode.
We are.
So it's only things we wish how Bitcoin could be even better than it already is.
True. So in that area, it could be better.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think that all of these things highlight another aspect, and that is that the second realm strategy, as we said before, has a lot to do with security, and we might actually want to go back to that and look into the future of how that could look like. But it's also about systemic thinking or systematic thinking. So it's not just thinking about isolated problems, but more about solution concepts, you know, spaces for solutions. The second realm, when the book came out, and ever since then, people have confused it with a manual. You know, mm-hmm. there are a lot of things that are touched on, you know, like proxy merchants and all that stuff. And people say, okay, why isn't there more detail? Why isn't there a blueprint? You know, and the reason is that it's, first of all, it's a way of thinking about things. You know, it's not, there is no blueprint, because there cannot be a blueprint except for very specific environments. You know, I mean, you could maybe make a blueprint for the second realm here in Berlin, you know, or aspects of it. You know, you could make a blueprint, but it might be completely different from what you would do in Chicago, for example. So instead of having a blueprint, you want a way of thought. You know, it's a strategic way of thought and not an operational blueprint.
The parallel way.
It's a parallel way. Yeah.
Is that how you would summarize it? This way of thought?
Yes, it is building parallel systems. that is the, and not just one system of a parallel kind, you know, but a lot of parallels to parallels to parallels to parallels. Yes.
And then you have all these questions. How do you adapt one parallel system? How do you change it? How do multiple parallel systems interact with each other? How do they interact with the first realm?
Exactly. Exactly. And you do that in all of the aspects of real human life, you know, or at least interactive in human life. You have this, this whole digital space, you know, where we need certain institutions or where certain institutions are well placed, you know, and that we can share, and where it makes sense to have certain systems that are relatively big, you know. And then we have local aspects that might more deal with social institutions, like how do we deal with conflict? How do we help each other in need? You know, how do we deal with attacks from the outside? You know, that's a relatively local question. But also cultural questions. You know, there's often the, I think it comes from US thought of libertarian school. They said people have this one vision of how, you know, free people should look like, you know, they have a cowboy hat, you know, they have a gun, you know, and they drive a pickup or something like that, you know. It's hilarious, you know. I mean, you don't want to be that dude when you're in the middle of Siberia, you know. That's not how it works, you know. You have a different culture, you know, you have different ideas, different language, etc. So even the culture of the second realm is not one culture. It's certain shared values, but they're expressed in a different way. And then you have like hyper local things, like how do you actually build a container, you know, and how do I actually deal with these specific five people there, you know. And that's a different thing again, you know. And it, for example, whatever services we're running here, you know, they're specific to our place, you know, and we have to figure out how to do that in the environment we're in. You know, the TAZ in, not going to name a name, you know, is going to be very different than that.
It's almost funny, I think, that sometimes I have the impression that people, they have, let's say, these libertarian ideals.
Yeah.
And then I think, okay, now I have to, all my social interactions have to be based on economic principles.
Yes.
Right? Everything needs a price.
Yes.
I cannot gift anything because that wouldn't be very economic.
Yes.
And it sometimes leads to this almost artificial human interactions. Right? There's nothing wrong with, let's say, building a anarcho-syndicalists TAZ. Nothing wrong with that. If you want to do that, go for it.
Exactly.
The principle of liberty is very compatible with different instantiations of how you interact economically.
Completely. And I think that one of the things you usually find out is that certain interactions don't make sense if they're monetarized.
I heard you figured it out once you have kids.
True. That is one of the things, you know. I mean, paying for good behavior is usually going really well, badly if you have kids, you know. But it's the same thing with friendships, you know. Having a friend that you can rely on, you know, loyalty, etc., that's not an economic transaction, you know. And being able to call your buddy, you know, to get rid of a body, you know, that's not an economic transaction. And if it is, you're almost certainly going to jail for it, you know. So there are a lot of aspects to human interaction that are not strictly monetarizable, you know, and they're not strictly economic. You know, there are a lot of about expectations and inner values and all these things. And I think that a lot of people are actually afraid of that. I kind of think that the modern state society, you know, like calling your neighbor, calling the police on your neighbor, you know, you're trained into interacting with other people through delegation, you know, you delegate your problems.
Yeah.
And in a way, you become dependent on all of that, you know, and you unlearn what it actually means to deal with humans directly, you know, yeah. And that it actually makes sense to have neighbors, that it makes sense to have friends, that it makes sense to have family, that it makes sense to have a tribe, you know, and that together you can do certain things that you could never pay for.
I think that for me, that makes it really exciting. The concept of the second realm for me is very exciting because you have all these abilities to experiment with different modes of interactions. But I think that's also what makes it somewhat makes people afraid of it, because they cannot follow the blueprint. I think a lot of people, they kind of fall into the blueprint, so to speak. Let's say, you know, what you describe is calling the cops on your neighbors, like the status blueprint. You know, there's a lot of blueprints there. You know, you go to school, you go to university, or learn some occupation, you get a job, you pay your taxes, whatever. And
then you wake up and realize that you wasted your life.
Yeah. But the same, like I said, for some libertarians and others, I think they fall into that same trap.
Yes.
It's like, okay, they learn a new ideology, you know, let's say they're now libertarians, or they vegans, you know, and now everything has to...
Or keto.
No, that's different. And then everything has to fit into that, you know, and without having to, without saying, okay, this is just another... First of all, it's an ideology. That doesn't mean it determines all my actions in my life. And even if it does determine some, it's still a toolbox. You can still choose. Let's say you can still choose to be an economic being and invite your friend for coffee, right?
Yes, there's no conflict there.
It's not mutually exclusive.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it really exciting, that once you realize that, you open up all this space for experimentation, but at the same time, it's frightening.
Yes.
It kind of brings me back to, in the beginning, what I said about, I think that was really my point about the sovereign individual, that it's kind of showed me like, okay, this is, it's just one mode that is now the dominant mode. It doesn't mean that it's the one. But it's really hard to grasp that emotionally.
Yes.
It's like the same as a second realm. Like it's kind of easy to read it, but to get it emotionally, it takes some time.
Yes.
Or some, it takes a physical implementation often to see it. To grasp the idea.
And it's not just seeing it, but actually doing it.
Yeah.
So a lot of things that, for example, are described in the book are things you cannot learn from a blueprint.
Yeah.
You know? So you cannot learn from a book how to be a good merchant. You know? You cannot learn from a book how to be a good proxy merchant. You know? That doesn't work like that, because it requires so many local skills that always change. It requires certain personality, etc. And you have to build it through experimentation. And it looks different everywhere. I mean, that's the other aspect with a system like the Second Realm, which is probably more a network of a lot of parallel systems to the First Realm. There can be so many different implementations for it. And that is actually one of the strengths of the system, is there are a lot of people on this planet that want more liberty. But the idea how that looks like can be very different, you know. So you have the communists on the one side that might not actually be power hungry, but just want to live in communism, you know. And then you have the weaker socialists in between. You have the anarcho-capitalists, you have the anarcho-syndicalists, you have all those different forms, you know. And in a network of communities, your community can be extremely different from a different community, and you can still have interaction if you want to. You don't have to, you know. I mean, you might find out that it doesn't make sense to trade with a communist, or you might find out that it makes a lot of sense and that they have ideas that you should copy. So in a way, the idea of the second realm is to create spaces of experimentation and parallel implementation without too many givens. There is not so much given, you know. It's not we copy one blueprint after the other, you know, because in the end, we'll end up with the same shit we're in, you know. But instead, it's an inspiration to imagine that there can be a different narratives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think often, like I said, with the emotional aspects, the biggest change in people you get when they can actually experience things. For me, it was, I have two examples. One was when I was on Anaplex for the first time, like many years ago. And, you know, like behind Tor with a pseudonym. And I kind of felt in this like crypto anarchy space era. And I thought, oh, wow, now I have free speech. I mean, I didn't really have free speech because Smuggler would kick me out if I, you know.
That's not true. Only in the public channels and only if you advocate violence.
Yeah, exactly. But I had this feeling like, okay, now I have more free speech than I would have in the you know, normal realm or in the physical world. And that really made an impression on me. Like, oh, wow, for the first time, there's a place where I have free speech. Or the first HTTP, this thing that they said, okay, it's Bitcoin only, it's cryptocurrency only, that really made a big impression. You know, like, you know, using it and having the separation from the state system in that sense. Although it was, you know, it was arguably inconvenient. You know, everybody had to exchange the money. People who didn't have Bitcoin, you know, they had to exchange it first. Technology wasn't as stable. But at the same time, it gave a lasting impression. And I think for others as well, it's really also about showing people, having them experience how an alternative could look like. It's really important.
Yeah. It's actually, when it comes specifically to the second realm, I have a similar story, which is very different. But there's this experiential aspect of it. And I was invited to a bar/club in Berlin that at the time was operated mostly by the Russian mafia. And it was like on this top floor of a high rise. And when the bar was open, you would come to that place, come to the ground floor, and you would have the bouncers and everything on the ground floor. And only if you checked out then, you know, they would call the elevator, you know, and they would go on the elevator with you and then bring you to the top floor where the actual thing was. And they had like security in the staircases. The other elevators were shut down, and then you came up there, and I basically just got into that space, looked around, and I said, "Wow, you know, basically this place is so hard to raid, it's so hard to surveil. You know, this is a different world. In a sense, it's a different world. You know." I knew exactly that if I started trouble with the wrong person there, I wouldn't have any chance of calling the police. You know, nobody would be able to help me from the outside. You know, I was completely in that world, you know, and
it's in the book, right?
It is actually one of the inspirations that really brought that home to me, you know, where I realized, okay, we're in the middle of Berlin of a very statist system, you know. And the only thing that the police could do here is actually send in an informant. You know, that's all they could do, you know. And that might go really wrong, you know, with those people, you know. Mm. And I was there and I realized, okay, I have to follow their rules and not the rules of the outside world, you know. And I also knew that by being there, those rules were not just something where I had duties, but also rights. You know, I realized, okay, I can actually do certain things here that I cannot do outside, you know, and they create this space for me where I can do that, you know. And I mean, there's this, I'm pretty sure actually that by now it's not true anymore. But back in the day, there was actually a helicopter landing pad on the top of that building, you know. I'm not sure if it's still there. But I've already thought, okay, this is, you know, these people actually thought it out well. You know, they have the ultimate security that you can get in a state system. I'm not sure what their legal structure and everything was. I don't know, you know. But they created a space that was territory of the Russian mafia, not of the German government, you know. And I really, you know, it really clicked. You know, I got into that room, looked around, and within seconds, I understood, you know. And there was telling, you know, because I thought, well, those people can do, you know, their strategy. That has actually worked for so long. You know, I was mentioning that before, you know, having a whole neighborhood, is that a good idea or not? The interesting thing is that those second realm spaces historically have existed forever. You know, you had ghettos, you know, not all of them voluntary, but they were relatively autonomous subsections of Venice, you know, where you would have the Jewish ghetto and the I think there was actually a German ghetto and so on and so on. So where you had those neighborhoods that were very autonomous. And there were actually fights between those territories from time to time. And it was actually a method to, on the one hand, preserve culture, the local cultures of those immigrant groups. But it was also giving those groups more freedom. You know, the Jewish ghetto would have completely different rules based on their religion. So, and so on and so on. And when you look around, you find similar concepts all around the world. You know, Chinatown is a really good example. So every Chinatown you see is a little bit, well, not just a little bit, it's very different from the whole society. You know, there are different rules there. You know, the same thing is true for the Turkish neighborhoods in Berlin, you know, or the Arab neighborhoods, you know. Yeah, formally they're controlled by the German government, you know. Practically, it matters much more what the old guy in front of the cafe has to say, you know. So when you look closely, you can see that in a lot of places, these different levels, layers, different realms already exist, you know. The only thing that doesn't exist in a big way so far is the layer of the liberty lovers.
Yeah, and a lot of these layers, I think, are also already temporary. For yes. example, a lot of, you know, festivals have this anarchy feel to it, you know, or they're like certain laws and rules are not in any practical effect. And I think that's a lot of the appeal for people as well. It's not just about taking drugs there. It's about also about, you know, that you can actually do things that you're not allowed to do in other places.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was for me also, I didn't realize it at the time, but when I think back now, it made a big impression on me. Like I once went to the Love Parade in Berlin, you know, when I was, it was a long time ago. And I went there by train, and the train actually, it became a temporary autonomous zone.
Exactly.
There was no rule enforcement at all anymore, you know. And I think it's a big appeal to people to, and it's very important that you can actually experience it.
Yes.
And sometimes you have to kind of put it together and explain or realize that it's actually, you know, some sort of temporary autonomous zone.
Yeah. I think that the main difference between the strategy of Second Realm and just a festival, temporary autonomous zone, is that the goal of the Second Realm is to have a certain continuity.
Yeah.
And that it also wants to provide more services that are relevant to people, you know, on a longer term basis. You know, you want to ideally build a system where you have the option to stay there, Sooner or later, the temporary should be a permanence.
The temporary aspect is, it's only temporary when you have to move.
Yes.
Ideally, you want to stay as long as you can.
Yeah, I think that I've been thinking about that actually the last few days. There's this differentiation that Hackenbay does, where he says, okay, there's these temporary autonomous zones, you know, they exist and then they disappear. And then some of them become relatively permanent, you know, and we have examples for that, like Christiana or a lot of communities actually in the countryside and squatted places, you know, they're relatively permanent autonomous zones. But actually the goal of the second realm, TAZ, might actually not be to be always a permanent autonomous zone, as at least not the physical one, but more like a mobile autonomous zone, you know, or a portable autonomous zone, you know, where you can say, okay, the geographic coordinates might slightly change, you know, but the people, the stuff, etc., can stay the same even when we're moving.
Yeah,
you know, so maybe we should call it a MUTZ, you know, mobile autonomous zone, because it's actually this permanence or relative permanence that allows you to have long term plans in that. A lot of festivals or a lot of people that go to festivals, they basically live from festival to festival, you know, and then in the meantime, they fall back into the first realm. But what you really want to have is at least the invitation to make it a thing that works around the year.
Yeah, that reminds me that we still haven't done it yet, but we should do it at some point to do some, you know, festival event. And we always thought about that, okay, let's do some sort of festival, but it ends when the last person leaves.
Yes.
You know? And then it might, you know, get into this mobile autonomous zone that when basically the caravan moves on to a different place.
It's called gypsies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's another good example for a parallel system. You know, the Sinti Roma gypsies. That's actually a complete, and it's just one of many examples. It's a complete culture, parallel system, etc., that is highly mobile and highly autonomous.
And they get away with a lot of stuff just because they're moving all the time.
Exactly.
Which is it's a very good strategy.
Exactly. I mean, you have that in Ireland, for example, traditional the Irish travelers or the British travelers. Which are whole communities that are not always, but relatively permanently on the move.
Mm.
They have their own culture. They have their own parallel systems of justice, security, money, healthcare, all these things, you know? And they have, I mean, often those communities form because people are exiled, you know, they're kicked out of the host society and that's the only thing they can do. But the interesting thing is, if you take modern technology and combine that with a permanent exile, you actually become a thing in yourself. You know, you don't have to be the poor slub, you know, but you can become productive. You can create capital. You can provide security and all these things, you know. So in a way, we're at this really interesting point in time where mobile autonomous zones, mobile communities can actually function and where you only settle down, you know, for a purpose. And then, you know, okay, you get into conflict, then you move, you know, or the business goes somewhere else, you move, you know, but you keep your community, you keep your capital.
Yeah, and I think some of them, like modern movements or ways to live, they already reflect that. For
yes.
example, you know, the idea of the digital nomad, or a lot of people now living in RVs, traveling, changing places all the time, virtualization of stuff like, okay, you put your company somewhere virtualized and put your savings in cryptos and stuff like that.
And it also makes different social structures more interesting again. I mean, we are kind of used to think in ethnicity and in nation, you know, which are the dominant narratives to a certain point. You know, the nation is more the statist idea, you know, the ethnicity is more like a cultural idea. But the interesting thing is that we might actually discover that there's another thing there, and that is tribes of ideas. You know, people that share certain set of ideas, no matter what their background is, you know, black, white, green, yellow, whatever. It doesn't matter where you come from. It matters what ideas you have,
yeah.
You know, what values you have. And in a way, it's this concept of tribes of mind, you know, that both interconnect through the internet, you know, but that can also have their own physical environments, you know. And there's an interesting, so if you're interested in the whole thinking, there's actually a nice book by Cory Doctorow. It's called Eastern Standard Tribe, where people form social allegiances based on the time zones in which they work, you know, no matter where on the planet they are. And I think that the changes of, you know, globalization, instant communication, transport and travel, make it more feasible again to connect with the people that have similar ideas or that have ideas that are productive. You know, you don't really want the same exact ideas, but slight differences, you know, and to form new social entities, which could be tribes of mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember we talked about this many, many years ago, and then a while ago I thought back on it and I realized that's exactly how I'm living now.
Yes.
You know, I have much more in common with, you know, some of my Eastern European friends than with the average German.
Completely. You know,
just because, like you said, we kind of share certain ideas, certain ideologies, certain ways how to live. Which makes it much more, you know, makes me share much more with them than, let's say, with an average German who I share the same language and the same citizenship. And I think also that's a great opportunity for more liberty, that more and more people, that they realize that that's the case.
Yeah.
That's also why it's helping a lot, I think, for these ideas that, people travel more, they move more, and experience that.
Unless the traveling itself becomes the main thing, you know. I mean, at a certain point, you have to realize that if you only travel around, you never form deep relationships, local relationships that you can rely on. You know, it's the old thing again. You know, humans That's are physical true. Beings. You know,
that's true. We should do a little critique of the crypto traveling circus here.
But only when it comes to the other currencies but Bitcoin.
Of course. No, but I think you're absolutely right. I think there is a problem in the scene that there are a lot of people who are traveling all the time.
Yeah.
And it makes it really hard to create any sort of deeper relationships.
And it makes it almost impossible to create territory together.
Yeah.
And without territory, you have nothing. You know, you'll always be subject to whoever controls the territory you happen to be in as a traveler. Yeah. You never have actual control. You never have actual security. In the end, you're just an atom in space.
Yeah. And I think it almost becomes a problem with the proliferation of spaces and projects. I mean, we kind of said we want a lot of projects, we want a lot of second realms, but it can also become too many too quickly. When I see this tendency that it's a lot of people like they in the scene, they see, let's say, a great space or a great project, and they're basically mobile, and they see it, and they're like, oh, this is really great. Let's start another one somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, okay, this is really great, let's join and improve it.
Yes.
You know, Of course, if you're very locally bound somewhere, and then you might want to start this similar project there. But often, I think it's detrimental, this idea that you always have to start a new thing immediately,
yeah,
instead of building existing ones.
Yeah, I think you have to try to build spaces towards their sustainable size, and then split. You know, that's probably the right way to approach it. You know, because then you actually have sustainable, reliable spaces, you know, that you can fall back on, even if your local project fails. I think that there needs to be some individual wisdom on how to invest into the bigger picture, you know, and to realize that if you invest into the bigger picture, you actually have much higher chances of a positive return, you know, than just spreading out resources and not making use of, you know, cooperation, specialization, pooling of capital, all these things. Plus, you actually want to have relatively big, loyal groups, you know, that you can rely on, you know, that you're part of, that you can fall back on, you know, and that can provide all those things that are really hard to buy, you know. I mean, security is one of these good concepts. You know, we think that security is something that you can really buy because there are security companies that you buy from. But especially when it comes to the security within communities, that's something you cannot really outsource. You know, if you outsource it, you become a subject. That's what happens with the police, you know. Because we outsource our security to the police, we become subject to the state in a certain degree. And some of the security you really want to do between people that want to rely on each other.
Yeah, and for that you need this high trust. You know, you mentioned yes. this.
And you need local. You need geographical closeness.
Yeah, you mentioned this. The friend you can call to bury a body metaphor.
Yeah. Well, it's not a metaphor. I have a list of people I know that I can call.
Yeah, I just wanted to say it's a metaphor.
Yeah, I don't have that many bodies to bury. Yes.
But that's exactly, I mean, these extreme cases are where you need people you can really trust and you know them well, and the person you can call at any time. And that's not going to be this dude you met on 3 crypto conferences.
That is living on a different continent.
Yeah.
You know, even if he were the dude, you know, you can, if you call him and say, I need your help burying a body, you know, the body will stink before the guy is there.
Yeah. But also, you're not going to build that kind of relationship with somebody.
True.
Yeah.
I actually think we should stop it here, because we actually gave as much of the emotional and strategic overview of the second realm. And I think everybody will notice that we're kind of enthusiastic about the idea. Plus, I'm not sure how long we've been recording now, but we don't want to create another episode that is 188 megabytes big. So we will for sure come back to some aspects of the second realm in the future. We would be really happy to get your feedback and your questions. Send them to bitstream@taz0.org. We really rely on your feedback in every way, and we've been really happy about all the comments we got, the critique, everything we got from the first episode. That was really uplifting. And amazingly, we actually got donations as well.
Yeah, we want to thank you a lot for all the donations we received. We were joking around a bit today that we are Bitcoin fans today. And the reason is that we got the most donations in Bitcoin.
You can buy our loyalty.
You can buy our loyalty. So we basically run this competition for every show that we're going to list the donations in the current in the order of the highest donations, and we're gonna mention the height of the donations in the currency which gave us the most donations. So this week Bitcoin won on the last meters, we have to say. Decred was first for Most of the month, but a few days ago, some hodler actually
went all in
and gave us a big donations. So we really want to thank everybody who donated, and we got 6.44 milli Bitcoin in Bitcoin, 4.77 milli Bitcoin in Decred, 2.58 milli Bitcoin of Bitcoin Cash, 2.3 milli Bitcoin of Monero, and sadly no Zcash. And we also calculated our salary. So if we deduct our cost from the donations, we actually made 47.5% of the German minimum wage.
We're rich now.
We're really rich. But you know, German minimum wage is the minimum. So we hope that we can reach that at some point.
Well, I hope that the product we deliver is actually worth something to you, our listener. Please show your love and do it by making a donation or by sending in good questions or comments or teach us. We're really happy about any kind of feedback. And we really thrive to make this thing good.
Yeah, we really don't want to put any advertisements in. And like Smuggler said, we really like to get questions. If we get too many questions, we might do an auction for the questions. But we're not there yet.
I think that's years in the future.
Yeah. So, I hope you enjoyed the show. And talk to you soon.
Bye.